and he of the Fetterlock, mounting upon his strong war horse, rode off through the forest. Chapter 4 King John. I'll tell thee what, my friend, he is a very serpent in my way, and wheresoe'er this foot of mine doth tread, he lies before me. Dost thou understand me? King John. There was brave feasting in the castle of York, to which Prince John had invited those nobles, prelates, and leaders by whose assistance he hoped to carry through his ambitious projects upon his brother's throne. Waldemar Fitzurse, his able and politic agent, was in secret at work amongst them, tempering all to that pitch of courage which was necessary ere making an open declaration of their purpose. But their enterprise was delayed by the absence of more than one main limb of the Confederacy, the stubborn and daring, though brutal, courage of Front de Boeuf, the buoyant spirits and bold bearing of de Bracy, the sagacity, martial experience, and renowned valour of Brion de Bois-Guilbert were important to the success of their conspiracy, and while cursing betwixt themselves their unnecessary and unmeaning absence, neither John nor his adviser dared to proceed without them. Isaac the Jew also seemed to have vanished, and with him the hope of certain sums of money, making up the subsidy for which Prince John had contracted with that Israelite and his brethren. This deficiency was likely to prove perilous in an emergency so critical. It was on the morning after the fall of Torquilstone that a confused report began to spread abroad in the city of York that de Bracy and de Bois-Guilbert, with their confederate Front de Boeuf, had been taken or slain. Waldemar brought the rumour to Prince John, announcing that he feared its truth the more that they had set out ill-attended with the purpose of committing an assault on the Saxon Cedric and his attendants. At another time the prince would have treated this deed of violence as a good jest, but now that it interfered with and impeded his own plans, he exclaimed against the perpetrators and spoke of the broken laws and the infringement of public order and of private property in a tone which might have become King Alfred. "The unprincipled marauders," he said. "Were I monarch of England, I would hang such transgressors over the drawbridges of their own castles." "But to become monarch of England," said his Achitophel coolly, "it is necessary not only that your grace should endure the transgressions of these unprincipled marauders, but that you should afford them your protection, notwithstanding your laudable zeal for the laws which they are in the habit of infringing. We shall have been finely helped up if the churl Saxon should have realized your grace's vision of converting feudal drawbridges into gibbets, and yonder bold-spirited Cedric seemeth one to whom such an imagination might occur. Your grace is well aware it will be dangerous to stir without Front de Boeuf, de Bracy, and the Templar, and yet we have gone too far to recede with safety." Prince John struck his forehead with impatience, and then began to stride up and down the apartment. "The villains," said he, "the base, treacherous villains to desert me at this pinch! Nay, say rather the feather-pated giddy fools," said Waldemar, "who must be toying with follies when such business was in hand." "What is to be done?" said the prince, stopping short before Waldemar.
"I know nothing which can be done," answered his counsellor, "save that which I have already taken order for. I came not to bewail this evil chance with your grace until I had done my best to remedy it."
"Thou art ever my better angel, Waldemar," said the prince, "and when I have such a chancellor to advise withal, the reign of John will be renowned in our annals. What hast thou commanded?"
"I have caused Louis Winkelbrand, de Bracy's lieutenant, to cause his trumpets to sound to horse, and to display his banner, and set presently forth towards the castle of Front de Boeuf, to do what yet may be done for the succour of our friends."
Prince John's face flushed with the pride of a spoilt child who has undergone what it conceives to be an insult.
"By the face of God," he said, "Waldemar Fitzurse, much hast thou taken upon thee, and over malapert thou wert to cause trumpet to blow or banner to be raised in a town where ourselves were in presence without our express command."
"I
crave your grace's pardon," said Fitzurse, internally cursing the idle vanity of his patron, "but when time pressed, and even the loss of minutes might be fatal, I judged it better to take this much burthen upon me in a matter of such importance to your grace's interest."
"Thou art pardoned, Fitzurse," said the prince gravely. "Thy purpose hath atoned for thy hasty rashness. But whom have we here? De Bracy himself, by the rood! And in strange guise doth he come before us."
It was, indeed, De Bracy, bloody with spurring, fiery red with speed. His armour bore all the marks of the late obstinate fray, being broken, defaced, stained with blood in many places, and covered with clay and dust from the crest to the spur. Undoing his helmet, he placed it on the table, and stood a moment as if to collect himself before he told his news.
"De Bracy," said Prince John, "what means this? Speak, I charge thee. Are the Saxons in rebellion?"
"Speak, De Bracy," said Fitzurse, almost in the same moment with his master. "Thou wert wont to be a man. Where is the Templar? Where Front de Boeuf?"
"The Templar is fled," said De Bracy.
"Front de Boeuf you will never see more. He has found a red grave among the blazing rafters of his own castle, and I alone am escaped to tell you."
"Cold news," said Waldemar, "to us, though you speak of fire and conflagration."
"The worst news is not yet said," answered De Bracy, and coming up to Prince John, he uttered in a low and emphatic tone the words,
"Richard is in England. I have seen and spoken with him."
Prince John turned pale, tottered, and caught at the back of an oaken bench to support himself, much like to a man who receives an arrow in his bosom.
"Thou ravest, De Bracy," said Fitzurse. "It cannot be."
"It is as true as truth itself," said De Bracy. "I was his prisoner, and spoke with him."
"With Richard Plantagenet, sayest thou?"
continued Fitzurse.
"With Richard Plantagenet," replied De Bracy. "With Richard Coeur de Lion, with Richard of England."
"And thou wert his prisoner?" said Waldemar.
"He is then at the head of a power?"
"No, only a few outlawed yeomen were around him, and to these his person is unknown. I heard him say he was about to depart from them. He joined them but to assist in the storming of Torquilstone."
"Aye," replied Fitzurse, "such is indeed the fashion of Richard. A true knight-errant he, and will wander in wild adventure, trusting the prowess of his single arm, like any Sir Guy or Sir Bevis, while the weighty affairs of his kingdom slumber, and his own safety is endangered. What dost thou propose to do, De Bracy?"
I offered Richard the service of my free lances, and he refused them. I will lead them to Hull, seize on shipping, and embark for Flanders. Thanks to the bustling times, a man of action will always find employment. And thou, Waldemar, wilt thou take lance and shield, and lay down thy policies, and wend along with me, and share the fate which God sends us?"
"I am too old, Maurice, and I have a daughter," answered Waldemar.
"Give her to me, Fitzurse, and I will maintain her as fits her rank, with the help of lance and stirrup," said De Bracy.
"Not so," answered Fitzurse. "I will take sanctuary in the church of St. Peter. The archbishop is my sworn brother."
During this discourse, Prince John had gradually awakened from the stupor into which he had been thrown by the unexpected intelligence, and had become attentive to the conversation which passed betwixt his followers.
"They fall off from me," he said to himself. "They hold no more by me than the withered leaf by the branch when a breeze blows on it. Hell and fiends! Can I shape no means for myself when I am deserted by these cravens?"
He paused, and there was an expression of diabolical passion in the constrained laugh with which he at length broke in on their conversation.
"My good lords! By the light of Our Lady's brow, I held ye sage men, bold men, ready-witted men. Yet ye throw down wealth, honour, pleasure, all that our noble game promised you, at the moment it might be won by one bold cast."
I understand you not, said de Bracy. So soon as Richard's return is blown abroad, he will be at the head of an army, and all is then over with us. I would counsel you, my lord, either to fly to France or take the protection of the Queen Mother.
I seek no safety for myself, said Prince John haughtily, that I could secure by a word spoken to my brother. But although you, de Bracy, and you, Waldemar Fitzurse, are so ready to abandon me, I should not greatly delight to see your heads set on Clifford's gate yonder. Thinkest thou, Waldemar, that the wily archbishop will not suffer thee to be taken from the very horns of the altar, would it make his peace with King Richard?
And forgettest thou, de Bracy, that Robert Estotteville lies betwixt thee and Hull with all his forces, and that the Earl of Essex is gathering his followers?
If we had reason to fear these levies even before Richard's return, trowest thou there is any doubt now which party their leaders will take? Trust me, Estotteville alone has strength enough to drive all thy free lances into the Humber.
Waldemar Fitzurse and de Bracy looked in each other's faces with blank dismay.
There is but one road to safety, continued the prince, and his brow grew black as midnight. This object of our terror journeys alone. He must be met withal.
Not by me, said de Bracy hastily. I was his prisoner, and he took me to mercy. I will not harm a feather in his crest.
Who spoke of harming him? Said Prince John with a hardened laugh. The knave will say next that I meant he should slay him. No, a prison were better. And whether in Britain or Austria, what matters it? Things will be but as they were when we commenced our enterprise. It was founded on the hope that Richard should remain a captive in Germany. Our uncle Robert lived and died in the castle of Cardiff.
Said Waldemar, your grandsire Henry sat more firm on his seat than your grace can. I say the best prison is that which is made by the sexton, no dungeon like a church vault.
I have said my say.
Prison or tomb, said de Bracy, I wash my hands of the whole matter.
Villain, said Prince John, thou wouldst not bewray our council.
Council was never bewrayed by me, said de Bracy haughtily, nor must the name of villain be coupled with mine.
Peace, sir knight, said Waldemar,
and you, good my lord, forgive the scruples of valiant de Bracy. I trust I shall soon remove them.
That passes your eloquence, Fitzurse, replied the knight.
Why, good Sir Maurice, rejoined the wily politician, start not aside like a scared steed, without at least considering the object of your terror. This Richard, but a day since, and it would have been thy dearest wish to have met him hand to hand in the ranks of battle. 100 times I have heard thee wish it.
Aye, said de Bracy, but that was, as thou sayest, hand to hand, and in the ranks of battle.
Thou never heardest me breathe a thought of assaulting him alone, and in a forest.
Thou art no good knight if thou dost scruple at it, said Waldemar. Was it in battle that Lancelot de Lac and Sir Tristram won renown? Or was it not by encountering gigantic knights under the shade of deep and unknown forests?
Aye, but I promise you, said de Bracy, that neither Tristram nor Lancelot would have been match hand to hand for Richard Plantagenet, and I think it was not their wont to take odds against a single man.
Thou art mad, de Bracy. What is it we propose to thee, a hired and retained captain of free companions, whose swords are purchased for Prince John's service, than a surprisal of our enemy? And this thou scrupulest, though thy patron's fortunes, those of thy comrades, thine own, and the life and honour of every one amongst us be at stake.
I tell you, said de Bracy sullenly, that he gave me my life. True, he sent me from his presence and refused my homage. So far I owe him neither favour nor allegiance, but I will not lift hand against him.
It needs not. Send Louis Winkelbrand and 100 of thy lances.
You have sufficient ruffians of your own, said de Bracy.
Not one of mine shall budge on such an errand.
Art thou so obstinate, de Bracy? Said Prince John. And wilt thou forsake me, after so many protestations of zeal for my service?
I mean it not, said de Bracy. I will abide by you in aught that becomes a knight, whether in the lists or in the camp, but this highway practice comes not within my vow.
Come hither, Waldemar, said Prince John. An unhappy prince am I. My father, King Henry, had faithful servants. He had but to say that he was plagued with a factious priest, and the blood of Thomas à Becket, saint though he was, stained the steps of his own altar. Tracy, Morvi, Brito, loyal and daring subjects, your names, your spirit, are extinct, and although Reginald Fitzurse hath left a son, he hath fallen off from his father's fidelity and courage.
He has fallen off in neither, said Waldemar Fitzurse, and since it may no better be, I will take on me the conduct of this perilous enterprise. Dearly, however, did my father purchase the praise of a zealous friend, and yet did his proof of loyalty to Henry fall far short of what I am about to afford, for rather would I assail a whole calendar of saints than put spear in rest against Coeur de Lion. De Brassy, to thee I must trust to keep up the spirits of the doubtful and to guard Prince John's person. If you receive such news as I trust to send you, our enterprise will no longer wear a doubtful aspect. Page, he said, hie to my lodgings and tell my armourer to be there in readiness, and bid Stephen Wetherill, Broad Thorsby, and the three spears of Spyinghow attend me instantly, and let the scoutmaster Hugh Bardon attend me also. Adieu, my prince, till better times. Thus speaking, he left the apartment.
He goes to make my brother prisoner, said Prince John to de Brassy, with as little touch of compunction as if it but concerned the liberty of a Saxon franklin. I trust he will observe our orders, and use our dear Richard's person with all due respect.
De Brassy only answered by a smile.
By the light of Our Lady's brow, said Prince John, our orders to him were most precise, though it may be you heard them not, as we stood together in the oriel window. Most clear and positive was our charge, that Richard's safety should be cared for, and woe to Waldemar's head if he transgress it.
I had better pass to his lodgings, said de Brassy, and make him fully aware of your grace's pleasure, for, as it quite escaped my ear, it may not perchance have reached that of Waldemar.
Nay, nay, said Prince John impatiently. I promise thee he heard me. And besides, I have farther occupation for thee, Maurice. Come hither. Let me lean on thy shoulder.
They walked a turn through the hall in this familiar posture, and Prince John, with an air of the most confidential intimacy, proceeded to say,
What thinkest thou of this Waldemar Fitzurse, my de Brassy? He trusts to be our chancellor.
Surely we will pause ere we give an office so high to one who shows evidently how little he reverences our blood by his so readily undertaking this enterprise against Richard.
Thou dost think, I warrant, that thou hast lost some of our regard by thy boldly declining this unpleasing task, but no, Maurice, I rather honour thee for thy virtuous constancy. There are things most necessary to be done, the perpetrator of which we neither love nor honour, and there may be refusals to serve us, which shall rather exalt in our estimation those who deny us our request. The arrest of my unfortunate brother forms no such good title to the high office of Chancellor as thy chivalrous and courageous denial establishes upon the truncheon of High Marshal. Think on this, de Brassy, and be gone to thy charge.
Fickle tyrant, murmured de Brassy as he left the presence of the prince. Evil luck have they who trust thee. Thy chancellor, indeed. He who hath the keeping of thy conscience shall have an easy charge, I trow. But High Marshal of England, that, said he, extending his arm as if to grasp the baton of office, and assuming a loftier stride along the antechamber, that is indeed a prize worth playing for. De Brassy had no sooner left the apartment than Prince John summoned an attendant.
Bid Hugh Bardon, our scoutmaster, come hither,
so soon as he shall have spoken with Waldemar Fitzurse. The scoutmaster arrived after a brief delay, during which John traversed his apartment with unequal and disordered steps, now slowly, now with a rapid, but always with a disordered pace.
"Barden," said he, "what did Waldemar desire of thee?"
Two resolved men, well acquainted with these northern wilds, and skilful in tracking the tread of man and horse.
"And thou hast fitted him?"
"Let your grace never trust me else," answered the master of the spies. "One is from Hexhamshire. He is wont to trace the Tynedale and Teviotdale thieves, as a bloodhound follows the slot of a hurt deer. The other is Yorkshire bred, and has twanged his bowstring right in merry Sherwood. He knows each glade and dingle, copse and high wood, betwixt this and Richmond."
"'Tis well," said the prince. "Goes Waldemar forth with them?"
"Instantly," said Barden.
"With what attendance?" replied John carelessly.
"Broad Thorsby goes with him, and Wetherall, whom they call for his cruelty Stephen Steelheart, and three northern men-at-arms that belonged to Ralph Middleton's gang. They are called the Spears of Spyinghow."
"'Tis well," said Prince John, then added after a moment's pause, "Barden, it imports our service that thou keep a strict watch on Maurice de Bracy, so that he shall not observe it, however, and let us know of his motions from time to time, with whom he converses, what he proposeth. Fail not in this, as thou wilt be answerable." Hugh Barden bowed and retired.
"If Maurice betrays me," said Prince John, "if he betrays me, as his bearing leads me to fear, I will have his head, were Richard thundering at the gates of York."
Chapter 5. Arouse the tiger of Hyrcanian deserts, strive with a half-starved lion for his prey, lesser the risk than rouse the slumbering fire of wild fanaticism. Anonymous. Our tale now returns to Isaac of York. Mounted upon a mule, the gift of the outlaw chief, and with two tall yeomen to act as his guard and guide, the Jew had set out for the preceptory of Templestowe for the purpose of negotiating his daughter's redemption. The preceptory was but a day's journey from the demolished castle of Torquilstone, and the Jew had hoped to reach it before nightfall. Accordingly, having dismissed his guides at the verge of the forest, and rewarded them with a piece of silver, he began to press on with such speed as his weariness permitted him to exert. But his strength failed him totally ere he had reached within 4 miles of Templestowe. Racking pains shot along his back and through his limbs, and the excessive anguish which he felt at heart, being now augmented by bodily suffering, he was rendered altogether incapable of proceeding farther than a small market town, where dwelt a Jewish rabbi of his tribe, eminent in the medical profession, and to whom Isaac was well known. Nathan ben Samuel received his suffering countryman with that kindness which the law prescribed, and which the Jews practised to each other. He insisted on his betaking himself to repose, and used such remedies as were then in most repute to check the progress of the fever, which terror, fatigue, and sorrow had brought upon the poor old Jew. On the morrow, when Isaac prepared to arise and renew his journey, Nathan remonstrated against his purpose, both as his host and as his physician. It might cost him, he said, his life. But Isaac replied that more than life and death depended on his going that morning to Templestowe.
To Templestowe,
said his host with surprise, again felt his pulse, and then muttered to himself,
his fever is abated, yet seems his mind somewhat alienated and disturbed. And why not to Templestowe?
Answered his patient.
I grant thee, Nathan, that it is a dwelling of those to whom the despised children of the promise are a stumbling block and an abomination. Yet thou knowest that pressing affairs of traffic sometimes carry us amongst these bloodthirsty Nazarene soldiers, and that we visit the preceptories of the Templars, as well as the commanderies of the Knights Hospitallers, as they are called.
I knew it well, said Nathan. But wottest thou that Luca de Beaumanoir, the chief of their order, and whom they term Grand Master, is now himself at Templestowe? I know it not, said Isaac. Our last letters from our brethren at Paris advised him to be at that city, beseeching Philip for aid against the Sultan Saladin. He hath since come to England, unexpected by his brethren, and he cometh among them with a strong and outstretched arm to correct and to punish. His countenance is kindled in anger against those who have departed from the vows which they have made, and great is the fear of those sons of Belial. Thou must have heard of his name. It is well known unto me, answered Isaac. The Gentiles deliver this Luca Beaumanoir as a man zealous to slaying for every point of the Nazarene law, and our brethren have termed him a cruel destroyer of the Saracens, and a cruel tyrant to the children of the promise.
And truly have they termed him, said Nathan the physician. Other Templars may be moved from the purpose of their heart by pleasure, or bribed by promise of gold and silver, but Beaumanoir is of a different stamp, hating sensuality, despising treasure, and pressing forward to that which they call the crown of martyrdom. The God of Jacob speedily send it unto him, and over them all. Especially hath this proud man extended his glove over the children of Judah, as holy David over Edom, holding the murder of a Jew to be an offering of as sweet savour as the death of a Saracen. Impious and false things, has he said, even of the virtues of our medicines, as if they were the devices of Satan, the Lord rebuke him. Nevertheless, said Isaac, I must present myself at Templestowe, though he hath made his face like unto a fiery furnace, 7 times heated.
He then explained to Nathan the pressing cause of his journey. The rabbi listened with interest, and testified his sympathy after the fashion of his people, rending his clothes and saying,
Ah, my daughter, ah, my daughter! Alas for the daughter of Zion! Alas for the captivity of Israel! Thou seest, said Isaac, how it stands with me, and that I may not tarry. Peradventure, the presence of this Luca Beaumanoir, being the chief man over them, may turn Brion de Bois Guilbert from the ill which he doth meditate, and that he may deliver to me my beloved daughter Rebecca.
Go thou, said Nathan ben Samuel, and be wise, for wisdom availed Daniel even in the den of lions into which he was cast, and may it go well with thee, even as thy heart wisheth. Yet if thou canst keep thee from the presence of the Grand Master, it were better with thee, for to do foul scorn to our people is his morning and evening delight. It may be, if thou couldst speak with Bois Guilbert in private, thou shalt the better prevail with him, for men say that these accursed Nazarenes are not at one together in the preceptory. May their counsels be confounded and brought to shame. But do thou, brother, return to me as if it were to the house of thy father, and bring me word how it has sped with thee, and well do I hope thou wilt bring with thee Rebecca, even the scholar of the wise Miriam, whose cures the Gentiles slandered as if they had been wrought by nigromancy.
Isaac accordingly bade his friend farewell, and about an hour's riding brought him before the preceptory of Templestowe. This establishment of the Templars was seated amidst fair meadows and pastures, which the devotion of the former proprietor had bestowed upon their order. It was strong and well fortified, a point never neglected by these knights, and which the disordered state of England rendered peculiarly necessary. 2 halberdiers clad in black guarded the drawbridge, and others, in the same sad livery, glided to and fro upon the walls with a funereal pace, resembling spectres more than soldiers. The inferior officers of the order were thus dressed, ever since their use of white garments, similar to those of the knights and esquires, had given rise to a combination of certain false brethren in the mountains of Palestine, terming themselves Templars, and bringing great dishonour on the order. A knight was now and then seen to cross the court in his long white cloak, his head depressed on his breast, and his arms folded. They passed each other, if they chanced to meet, with a slow, solemn, and mute greeting, for such was the rule of their order, quoting thereupon the holy texts, "In many words thou shalt not avoid sin," and "Life and death are in the power of the tongue." In a word, the stern ascetic rigour of the temple discipline, which had so long been exchanged for prodigal and licentious indulgence, seemed at once to have revived at Templestowe under the severe eye of Luca Beaumanoir. Isaac paused at the gate to consider how he might seek entrance in the manner most likely to bespeak favour, for he was well aware that to his unhappy race the reviving fanaticism of the order was not less dangerous than their unprincipled licentiousness, and that his religion would be the object of hate and persecution in the one case, as his wealth would have exposed him in the other to the extortions of unrelenting oppression. Meantime, Luca Beaumanoir walked in a small garden belonging to the preceptory, included within the precincts of its exterior fortification, and held sad and confidential communication with a brother of the order who had come in his company from Palestine. The Grand Master was a man advanced in age, as was testified by his long grey beard and the shaggy grey eyebrows, overhanging eyes, of which, however, years had been unable to quench the fire. A formidable warrior, his thin and severe features retained the soldier's fierceness of expression. An ascetic bigot, they were no less marked by the emaciation of abstinence and the spiritual pride of the self-satisfied devotee. Yet with these sinister traits of physiognomy, there was mixed something striking and noble, arising doubtless from the great part which his high office called upon him to act among monarchs and princes, and from the habitual exercise of supreme authority over the valiant and high-born knights, who were united by the rules of the order. His stature was tall, and his gait, undepressed by age and toil, was erect and stately. His white mantle was shaped with severe regularity, according to the rule of St. Bernard himself, being composed of what was then called burl cloth, justly fitted to the size of the wearer, and bearing on the left shoulder the octangular cross peculiar to their order, shaped in red cloth. No vair or ermine decked this garment, but in respect of his age, the Grand Master, as permitted by the rules, wore his doublet trimmed and lined with the softest lambskin, dressed with the wool outwards, which was the nearest approach he could regularly make to the use of furs, then the greatest luxury of dress. In his hand he bore that singular abacus, or staff of office, with which Templars are often represented, having at the upper end a round plate, on which was engraved the cross of the order, inscribed within a circle, or an awl, as heralds term it. His companion, who attended on this great personage, had nearly the same dress in all respects, but his extreme deference towards his superior showed that no other equality subsisted betwixt them. The preceptor, for such he was in rank, walked not in a line with the Grand Master, but just so far behind that Beaumanoir could speak to him without turning round his head.
"Conrad," said the Grand Master, "dear companion of my battles and my toils, to thy faithful bosom alone I can confide my sorrows. To thee alone can I tell how oft, since I came to this kingdom, I have desired to be dissolved and to be with the just. Not one object in England hath met mine eye on which it could repose with pleasure, save the tombs of our brethren beneath the massive roof of our temple church in yonder proud capital. O valiant Robert de Roux," did I exclaim internally, as I gazed upon these good soldiers of the cross, where they lie sculptured on their tombs, "O worthy William de Marichal, open your marble cells and take to your repose a weary brother who would rather strive with 100,000 pagans than witness the decay of our holy order." "It is but true," answered Conrad Mountfitchet, "it is but too true, and the irregularities of our brethren in England are even more gross than those in France." "Because they are more wealthy," answered the Grand Master. "Bear with me, brother, though I should something vaunt myself. Thou knowest the life I have led, keeping each point of my order, striving with devils embodied and disembodied, striking down the roaring lion, who goeth about seeking whom he may devour, like a good knight and a devout priest, wheresoever I met with him, even as blessed Saint Bernard hath prescribed to us in the 45th capital of our rule, ut leo semper feriatur. But, by the holy temple, the zeal which hath devoured my substance and my life, yea, the very nerves and marrow of my bones, by that very holy temple I swear to thee that save thyself, and some few who still retain the ancient severity of our order, I look upon no brethren whom I can bring my soul to embrace under that holy name. What say our statutes, and how do our brethren observe them? They should wear no vain or worldly ornament, no crest upon their helmet, no gold upon stirrup or bridle pit, yet who now go pranked out so proudly and so gaily as the poor soldiers at the temple. They are forbidden to take one bird by means of another, to shoot beasts with bow or arblast, to hollow to a hunting hound, or to spur the horse after game. But now, at hunting and hawking and each idle sport of wood and river, who so prompt as they in all these fond vanities? They were forbidden to read, save what their superiors permitted, or what holy thing was read aloud during the hours of refection, and they were commanded to extirpate magic and heresy. Lo! They are charged with studying the accursed cabalistical secrets of the Jews and the magic of the Paynim Saracens. Simpleness of diet was prescribed to them, roots, pottage, gruels, eating flesh but thrice a week, because the accustomed feeding on flesh is dishonourable corruption of the body, and behold, their tables groan under delicate fare. Their drink was to be water, and now to drink like a Templar is the boast of each jolly boon companion. This very garden, filled as it is with curious herbs and trees sent from the eastern climes, better beseems the haram of an unbelieving emir than the plot which Christian monks should devote to raise their pot herbs. And, oh, Conrad, well it were that the relaxation of discipline stopped even here. Well thou knowest that we were forbidden to receive those devout women who at the beginning were associated as sisters of our order, because, saith the 56th chapter, the ancient enemy hath, by female society, withdrawn many from the right path to paradise. Nay, in the last capital, being as it were the copestone which our blessed founder placed on the pure and undefiled doctrine which he had enjoined, we are prohibited from offering, even to our sisters and our mothers, the kiss of affection. Ut omnium mulierum fugiantur oscula. I shame to speak, I shame to think of the corruptions which have rushed in upon us, even like a land flood. The souls of our pious founders, the spirits of Hugh de Payon and Godfrey de Saint-Omer, and of the blessed seven who with them first joined in dedicating their lives to the defence of the temple, are disturbed even in the enjoyment of paradise itself. I have seen them, Conrad, in the visions of the night. Their sainted eyes shed tears for the follies and sins of their brethren, and for the foul and shameful luxury in which they wallow. Beaumanoir, they say, thou slumberest, awake! There is a stain in the fabric of the temple, deep and foul as that left by the streaks of leprosy in the walls of the infected houses of old. The soldiers of the cross, who should shun the glance of woman as the eye of a basilisk, live in open sin, not with the females of their own race only, but with the daughters of the accursed heathen and more accursed Jew. Beaumanoir, thou sleepest, up and avenge our cause. Slay the sinners, male and female. Take to thee the brand of Phineas. The vision fled, Conrad, but as I awaked, I could still hear the clank of their mail and see the waving of their white mantles. And I will do according to their word. I will purify the fabric of the temple, and the unclean stones in which the plague is will I remove and cast out of the building. Yet bethink thee, reverend father, said Mount Fitchett, the stain hath become ingrained by time and consuetude. Let thy reformation be cautious, as it is just and wise. No, Mount Fitchett, it must be sharp and sudden. The order is on the crisis of its fate. The sobriety, self-devotion, and piety of our predecessors made us powerful friends. Our presumption, our wealth, our luxury have raised up against us mighty enemies. We must cast away these riches, which are a temptation to princes. We must lay down that presumption, which is an offence to them. We must reform that license of manners, which is a scandal to the whole Christian world. Or, mark my words, the order of the temple will be utterly demolished, and the place thereof shall no longer be known among the nations.
Now may God avert such a calamity, said the preceptor.
Amen, said the Grand Master with solemnity, but we must deserve his aid. I tell thee, Conrad, that neither the powers in heaven nor the powers on earth will longer endure the wickedness of this generation. My intelligence is sure. The ground on which our fabric is reared is already undermined, and each addition we make to the structure of our greatness will only sink it the sooner in the abyss. We must retrace our steps and show ourselves the faithful champions of the cross, sacrificing to our calling not alone our blood and our lives, not alone our lusts and our vices, but our ease, our comforts, and our natural affections, and many a pleasure that may be lawful to others, but is forbidden to the vowed soldier of the temple.
At this moment a squire, clothed in a threadbare vestment, for the aspirants after this holy order wore during their novitiate the cast-off garments of the knights, entered the garden, and, bowing profoundly before the Grand Master, stood silent, awaiting his permission, he presumed to tell his errand.
"Is it not more seemly," said the Grand Master, "to see this Damian, clothed in the garments of Christian humility, thus appear with reverent silence before his superior, than but 2 days since, when the fond fool was decked in a painted coat, and jangling as pert and as proud as any popinjay? Speak, Damian, we permit thee. What is thine errand?"
"A Jew stands without the gate, noble and reverend father, who prays to speak with Brother Brian de Bois Guilbert."
"Thou wert right to give me knowledge of it," said the Grand Master. "In our presence a preceptor is but as a common confrere of our order, who may not walk according to his own will, but that of his master. Even according to the text, 'In the hearing of the ear, he hath obeyed me.' It imports us especially to know of this Bois Guilbert's proceedings," said he, turning to his companion.
"Report speaks him brave and valiant," said Conrad.
"And truly is he so spoken," said the Grand Master. "In our valour only we are not degenerated from our predecessors, the heroes of the cross. But Brother Brian came into our order, a moody and disappointed man, stirred, I doubt me, to take our vows and to renounce the world, not in sincerity of soul, but as one whom some touch of light discontent had driven into penitence. Since then he hath become an active and earnest agitator, a murmurer and a machinator, and a leader amongst those who impugn our authority, not considering that the rule is given to the master, even by the symbol of the staff and the rod, the staff to support the infirmities of the weak, the rod to correct the faults of delinquents. Damian," he continued, "lead the Jew to our presence."
The squire departed with a profound reverence, and in a few minutes returned, marshalling in Isaac of York. No naked slave, ushered into the presence of some mighty prince, could approach his judgment seat with more profound reverence and terror than that with which the Jew drew near to the presence of the Grand Master. When he had approached within the distance of 3 yards, Beaumanoir made a sign with his staff that he should come no farther. The Jew kneeled down on the earth, which he kissed in token of reverence, then, rising, stood before the Templars, his hands folded on his bosom, his head bowed on his breast, in all the submission of Oriental slavery.
"Damian," said the Grand Master, "retire, and have a guard ready to await our sudden call, and suffer no one to enter the garden until we shall leave it."
The squire bowed and retreated.
"Jew," continued the haughty old man, "mark me. It suits not our condition to hold with thee long communication, nor do we waste words and time upon any one. Wherefore be brief in thy answers to what questions I shall ask thee, and let thy words be of truth. For if thy tongue doubles with me, I will have it torn from thy misbelieving jaws."
The Jew was about to reply, but the Grand Master went on.
Peace, unbeliever! Not a word in our presence, save in answer to our questions. What is thy business with our brother, Brion de Bois-Guilbert?
Isaac gasped with terror and uncertainty. To tell his tale might be interpreted into scandalizing the order, yet unless he told it, what hope could he have of achieving his daughter's deliverance? Beaumanoir saw his mortal apprehension and condescended to give him some assurance.
Fear nothing, he said, for thy wretched person, Jew, so thou dealest uprightly in this matter. I demand again to know from thee thy business with Brion de Bois-Guilbert.
I am bearer of a letter, stammered out the Jew, so please your reverend valour, to that good knight, from Aymer, prior of the Abbey of Jorvaux.
Said I not these were evil times, Conrad, said the master. A Cistercian prior sends a letter to a soldier of the temple and can find no more fitting messenger than a misbelieving Jew? Give me the letter.
The Jew, with trembling hand, undid the folds of his Armenian cap, in which he had deposited the prior's tablets for the greater security, and was about to approach, with hand extended and body crouched, to place it within the reach of his grim interrogator.
Back, dog! Said the Grand Master. I touch not misbelievers, save with a sword. Conrad, take thou the letter from the Jew, and give it to me.
Beaumanoir, being thus possessed of the tablets, inspected the outside carefully, and then proceeded to undo the pack thread which secured its folds.
Reverend Father, said Conrad, interposing, though with much deference, wilt thou break the seal?
And will I not? Said Beaumanoir, with a frown. Is it not written in the 42nd capital, De Lectione Literarum, that a Templar shall not receive a letter, no, not from his father, without communicating the same to the Grand Master, and reading it in his presence?
He then perused the letter in haste, with an expression of surprise and horror, read it over again more slowly, then, holding it out to Conrad with one hand, and slightly striking it with the other, exclaimed,
Here is goodly stuff for one Christian man to write to another, and both members, and no inconsiderable members, of religious professions. When, said he solemnly and looking upward, wilt thou come with thy fanners to purge the threshing floor?
Mount Fitchett took the letter from his superior and was about to peruse it.
Read it aloud, Conrad, said the Grand Master, and do thou, to Isaac, attend to the purport of it, for we will question thee concerning it.
Conrad read the letter, which was in these words.
Aymer, by divine grace, prior of the Cistercian house of St. Mary's of Jorvaux, to Sir Brion de Bois-Guilbert, a knight of the Holy Order of the Temple, wisheth health with the bounties of Bacchus and of my Lady Venus.
Touching our present condition, dear brother, we are a captive in the hands of certain lawless and godless men who have not feared to detain our person and put us to ransom, whereby we have also learned of Rondebeuf's misfortune and that thou had escaped with that fair Jewish sorceress whose black eyes have bewitched thee. We are heartily rejoiced of thy safety. Nevertheless, we pray thee to be on thy guard in the matter of this second witch of Endor, for we are privately assured that your great master, who careth not a bean for cherry cheeks and black eyes, comes from Normandy hither to diminish your mirth and amend your misdoings. Wherefore we pray you heartily to beware, and to be found watching, even as the holy text hath it, inveniantur vigilantes. And the wealthy Jew, her father, Isaac of York, having prayed of me letters in his behalf, I give him these, earnestly advising that you do hold the damsel to ransom, seeing he will pay you from his bags as much as may find 50 damsels upon safer terms, whereof I trust to have my part when we make merry together as true brothers, not forgetting the wine cup. For what saith the text? Vinum latificat cor hominis. And again, rex delectabitur pulchritudine tua. Till which merry meeting, we wish you farewell.
given from this den of thieves about the hour of matins, Aymer, Prior, S.M. Your Volcientius. Postscriptum, truly your golden chain hath not long abidden with me, and will now sustain, around the neck of an outlaw deer-stealer, the whistle wherewith he calleth on his hounds.
"What sayst thou to this, Conrad?" said the Grand Master. "Den of thieves, and a fit residence is a den of thieves for such a prior. No wonder that the hand of God is upon us, and that in the Holy Land we lose place by place, foot by foot, before the infidels, when we have such churchmen as this Aymer.
And what meaneth he, I trow, by this second witch of Endor?" said he to his confidant, something apart.
Conrad was better acquainted, perhaps by practice, with the jargon of gallantry than was his superior, and he expounded the passage which embarrassed the Grand Master to be a sort of language used by worldly men towards those whom they loved par amour, but the explanation did not satisfy the bigoted Beaumanoir.
"There is more in it than thou dost guess, Conrad. Thy simplicity is no match for this deep abyss of wickedness. This Rebecca of York was a pupil of that Miriam of whom thou hast heard. Thou shalt hear the Jew own it even now."
Then, turning to Isaac, he said aloud,
"Thy daughter, then, is prisoner with Brian de Bois-Guilbert?"
"Aye, reverend and valorous sir, and whatsoever ransom a poor man may pay for her deliverance..."
"Peace," said the Grand Master. "This thy daughter hath practised the art of healing, hath she not?"
"Aye, gracious sir, and knight and yeoman, squire and vassal, may bless the goodly gift which heaven hath assigned to her. Many a one can testify that she hath recovered them by her art when every other human aid had proved vain. But the blessing of the God of Jacob was upon her."
Beaumanoir turned to Mountfitchet with a grim smile.
"See, brother," he said, "the deceptions of the devouring enemy. Behold the baits with which he fishes for souls, giving a poor space of earthly life in exchange for eternal happiness hereafter. Well said our blessed rule, semper percutiatur leo vorans. Upon the lion, down with the destroyer," said he, shaking aloft his mystic abacus, as if in defiance of the powers of darkness. "Thy daughter worketh her cures, I doubt not." Thus he went on to address the Jew, "by words and sigils and periapts and other cabalistical mysteries."
"Nay, reverend and brave knight," answered Isaac, "but in chief measure by a balsam of marvellous virtue."
"Whence had she that secret?" said Beaumanoir.
"It was derived to her," answered Isaac reluctantly, "from Miriam, a sage matron of our tribe."
"Ah, false Jew! Was it from that witch Miriam, the abomination of whose enchantments has been heard of throughout every Christian land?" exclaimed the Grand Master, crossing himself. "Her body was burned at a stake, and her ashes scattered to the four winds. And so be it with me and mine order, and I do not as much to her pupil, and more also. I will teach her to throw spell and incantation over the soldiers of the Blessed Temple. There, Damien, spurn this Jew from the gate. Shoot him dead if he oppose or turn again. With his daughter we will deal as the Christian law and our own high office best warrant."
Poor Isaac was hurried off accordingly, all his entreaties and even his offers unheard and disregarded. He could do no better than return to the house of the rabbi, and endeavour, through his means, to learn how his daughter was to be disposed of. He had hitherto feared for her honour. He was now to tremble for her life. Meanwhile, the Grand Master ordered to his presence the preceptor of Templestowe.
Chapter 6. "Say not my art is fraud. All live by seeming. The beggar begs with it, and the gay courtier gains land and title, rank and rule by seeming.
The clergy scorn it not, and the bold soldier will eke with it his service. All admit it, all practice it, and he who is content with showing what he is shall have small credit in church or camp or state. So wags the world. Old Play. Albert Malvoisin, president, or in the language of the order, preceptor of the establishment of Templestowe, was brother to that Philip Malvoisin, who has been already occasionally mentioned in this history, and was, like that baron, in close league with Brian de Bois Guilbert. Amongst dissolute and unprincipled men, of whom the Temple Order included but too many, Albert of Templestowe might be distinguished, but with this difference from the audacious Bois Guilbert, that he knew how to throw over his vices and his ambition a dark veil of hypocrisy, and to assume in his exterior the fanaticism which he internally despised. Had not the arrival of the Grand Master been so unexpectedly sudden, he would have seen nothing at Templestowe which might have seemed to argue any relaxation of discipline, and even although surprised, and to a certain extent detected, Albert Malvoisin listened with such respect and apparent contrition to the rebuke of his superior, and made such haste to reform the particulars which he censured, succeeded, in fine, so well in giving the air of ascetic devotion to a family which had been lately devoted to license and pleasure, that Luca Beaumanoir began to entertain a higher opinion of the preceptor's morals than the first appearance of the establishment had inclined him to adopt. But these favourable sentiments on the part of the Grand Master were greatly shaken by the intelligence that Albert had received within the House of Religion the Jewish captive, and, as was to be feared, the paramour of a brother of the order, and when Albert appeared before him, he was regarded with unwonted sternness.
"There is in this mansion, dedicated to the purposes of the Holy Order of the Temple," said the Grand Master in a severe tone, "a Jewish woman, brought hither by a brother of religion, by your connivance, Sir Preceptor."
Albert Malvoisin was overwhelmed with confusion, for the unfortunate Rebecca had been confined in a remote and secret part of the building, and every precaution used to prevent her residence there from being known. He read in the looks of Beaumanoir ruin to Bois Guilbert and to himself, unless he should be able to avert the impending storm.
"Why are you mute?" continued the Grand Master. "Is it permitted to me to reply?" answered the preceptor, in a tone of the deepest humility, although by the question he only meant to give an instant's space for arranging his ideas.
"Speak, you are permitted," said the Grand Master. "Speak, and say, knowest thou the capital of our holy rule, De commilitonibus templi in sancta civitate, qui cum miserimis mulieribus versantur, propter oblectationem carnis?"
"Surely, most reverend father," answered the preceptor, "I have not risen to this office in the order, being ignorant of one of its most important prohibitions."
"How comes it, then, I demand of thee once more, that thou hast suffered a brother to bring a paramour, and that paramour a Jewish sorceress, into this holy place, to the stain and pollution thereof?"
"A Jewish sorceress?" echoed Albert Malvoisin. "Good angels guard us."
"Aye, brother, a Jewish sorceress. Darest thou deny that this Rebecca, the daughter of that wretched usurer Isaac of York, and the pupil of the foul witch Miriam, is now, shame to be thought or spoken, lodged within this thy preceptory?"
"Your wisdom, reverend father," answered the preceptor, "hath rolled away the darkness from my understanding. Much did I wonder that so good a knight as Brian de Bois Guilbert seemed so fondly besotted on the charms of this female, whom I received into this house merely to place a bar betwixt their growing intimacy, which else had cemented at the expense of the fall of our valiant and religious brother.
Hath nothing then as yet passed betwixt them in breach of his vow?" demanded the Grand Master.
"What? Under this roof?" said the preceptor, crossing himself. "Saint Magdalene and the 10,000 virgins forbid. No!
If I have sinned in receiving her here, it was in the erring thought that I might thus break off our brother's besotted devotion to this Jewess, which seemed to me so wild and unnatural that I could not but ascribe it to some touch of insanity, more to be cured by pity than by reproof. But since your reverend wisdom have discovered this Jewish queen to be a sorceress, perchance it may account fully for his enamoured folly.
It doth," said Beaumanoir. "See, brother Conrad, the peril of yielding to the first devices and blandishments of Satan. We look upon woman only to gratify the lust of the eye, and to take pleasure in what men term her beauty, and the ancient enemy obtains power over us to complete, by talisman and spell, the work which was begun by idleness and folly. It may be that our brother Bois Guilbert does in this matter deserve rather pity than severe chastisement, rather the support of the staff than the stripes of the rod, and that our admonitions and prayers may turn him from his folly and restore him to his brethren."
"It were deep pity," said Conrad Mountfitchet, "to lose to the order one of its best lances, when the holy community most requires the aid of its sons. 300 Saracens hath this Brion de Bois Guilbert slain with his own hand."
"The blood of these accursed dogs," said the Grand Master, "shall be a sweet and acceptable offering to the saints and angels whom they despise and blaspheme, and with their aid will we counteract the spells and charms with which our brother is entwined, as in a net. He shall burst the bands of this Delilah, as Samson burst the two new cords with which the Philistines had bound him, and shall slaughter the infidels, even heaps upon heaps. But concerning this foul witch, who hath flung her enchantments over a brother of the Holy Temple, assuredly she shall die the death."
"But the laws of England," said the preceptor, who, though delighted that the Grand Master's resentment, thus fortunately averted from himself and Bois Guilbert, had taken another direction, began now to fear he was carrying it too far.
"The laws of England," said Beaumanoir, "permit and enjoin each judge to execute justice within his own jurisdiction. The most petty baron may arrest, try, and condemn a witch found within his own domain, and shall that power be denied to the Grand Master of the Temple within the preceptories of his order? No, we will judge and condemn. The witch shall be taken out of the land, and the wickedness thereof shall be forgiven. Prepare the castle hall for the trial of the sorceress."
Albert Malvoisin bowed and retired, not to give directions for preparing the hall, but to seek out Brion de Bois Guilbert and communicate to him how matters were like to terminate. It was not long ere he found him foaming with indignation at a repulse he had of new sustained from the fair Jewess.
"The unthinking," he said, "the ungrateful! Who, amidst blood and flames, would have saved her life at the risk of his own? By heaven, Malvoisin, I abode till roof and rafter crackled and crashed around me. I was the butt of 100 arrows. They rattled on mine armour like hailstones against a latticed casement, and the only use I made of my shield was for her protection. This did I endure for her, and now this self-willed girl upbraids me because I did not leave her to perish, and refuses me not only the slightest proof of gratitude, but even the most distant hopes that she will ever be brought to grant any. The devil that possessed her race with obstinacy has concentred its full force in her single person."
"The devil," said the preceptor, "hath, I think, possessed you both. How oft have I preached to you caution, at least, if not continence? Did I not tell you that there were willing enough Christian damsels to be met with who would think it sin to refuse so brave a knight le don d'amoureuse merci? And you must needs anchor your affection on a wilful, obstinate Jewess? By the mass, I think old Luca Beaumanoir judges right when he maintains she hath cast a spell over you."
"Luca Beaumanoir," said Bois Guilbert, "are these thy precautions, Malvoisin? Hast thou suffered the dotard to learn that Rebecca is in the preceptory?"
"How could I help it?" answered the preceptor. "I neglected nothing that could keep secret your mystery, but it is betrayed. And whether by the devil or no, the devil only can tell. but I have turned the matter as I could. You are safe if you renounce Rebecca. You are pitied, the victim of magical delusion. She is a sorceress and must suffer as such.
She shall not, by heaven, said Bois Guilbert.
By heaven she must and will, said Malvoisin. Neither you nor anyone else can save her. Lucas Beaumanoir hath settled that the death of a Jewess will be a sin-offering sufficient to atone for all the amorous indulgences of the Knights Templars, and thou knowest he hath both the power and will to execute so reasonable and pious a purpose.